We are talking today with Dr. Kent Keel, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of New Mexico. He's the Director of the Mobile MRI Clinical Cognitive Neuroscience Unit, often referred to as the MIND Research Network. So you're doing fascinating stuff. I got to read the article in the New Yorker, which was a really great write-up.
Yeah, John Seabrook, the author, really actually spent quite a bit of time here, almost 2 weeks, over the course of about 6 months, and he was really great to work with, actually. We thought he did a really good job on the science and the content. So.
Yeah, I thought he did a really great job. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the MRI project as it pertains to psychopathy?
Sure. So, you know, like all psychiatric conditions and mental health disorders, we're trying to use brain imaging to try to help understand the different brain systems that might be implicated in psychopathy. And, you know, the ultimate goal being once we can understand which systems are involved, we might be able to design some treatments that might specifically work on those systems. But right now we really only have kind of guessing games going on about which brain systems might be implicated and which brain systems aren't implicated, just as important. Mm-hmm. And so that's the impetus behind doing that. What makes the condition particularly difficult to study, of course, is that they usually end up in facilities like prisons, and at least they tend to, quite a few of them tend to congregate there. So mm-hmm. with that understanding, it can be exceedingly difficult to actually do brain imaging studies within prison populations, mostly because most states won't or don't have the resources, or there's not the grant dollars to transport inmates from prisons to universities to get MRI scans.
Mm-hmm.
So my solution was to design and build a mobile MRI system that could go the reverse. So we take the MRI system to them, and then they can participate in great numbers. And that's really been the goal over the past, it's going to be a goal for a long time, but that's what we really have seen come to fruition over the last 18 months.
Mm-hmm. And what are you seeing as far as the parts of the brain sections that are implicated?
So a couple of years ago, I did a very large review where I identified through converging methods some animal research, some human neuropsychological research, like from patients who've had brain damage, like you may have heard of the case of Phineas Gage, who was a railroad worker who had in the 1800s, who had an iron rod that got blasted through his head, and mm-hmm. it damaged some parts of his orbital frontal cortex and anterior cingulate. And from there's two things about the story that are pretty fascinating. First is that he survived the accident, and the second is that his personality just dramatically changed. He became impulsive, garrulous, nomadic, sensation-seeking, a lot of the traits that we often associate with psychopathy. Mm-hmm. And so based on that kind of large literature that's out there now, and a few other studies that have been done in psychopathy, I articulated that there's a system or circuit that you could call the paralimbic system. It embraces classic older limbic areas, you know, like the mm-hmm. areas that people mostly associate with deeper emotional, affective, and meaning, mm-hmm. And then some newer areas that are not classically included in the limbic system. So, and the idea, and so I've basically articulated the theory that this system hasn't developed normally for whatever reason, and that and we're testing that hypothesis now. Is this paralimbic system not functioning? Does it not look normally structurally? Does it not have normal connections with other brain regions? All the things that we can use MRI to study, we're trying to examine. And then from that, if it really turns out to be the case, well, we already have some drugs that we know work primarily on that system. We have some treatments that we know that might help remediate those systems, some cognitive behavioral treatments. And so we would have a much better targeted intervention or region to do interventions in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've got a question about the fMRI and your use of the PCLR. In the article in the New Yorker, they say that you first use the PCLR to distinguish psychopaths from non-psychopaths before the MRI testing. Now, have you tested non-psychopathic criminals as well? And if so, what kind of differences did you find between the psychopaths and the non-psychopaths?
Sure. Actually, so first, yes, we do use the PCLR. That's still considered the very best measure for assessing psychopathy that exists, especially within forensic populations. The second answer to your question is that we certainly do compare psychopathic offenders to non-psychopathic offenders. And so it is the non-psychopathic offenders that usually form our major comparison group,
okay.
Although we have taken on, studied all of the tasks in what you would call kind of a community control group, so people who are typically not incarcerated or haven't been incarcerated and haven't had any experiences, like major experiences or problems with drugs, for example, or alcohol. And so we compare all basically three of those groups. Really, there's four groups. We usually take high, medium, and low on psychopathy. And then we also have a control group that's non-criminal. And so we usually look at all three of those. Now, in practice, what we typically find is that most controls look very similar to the non-psychopathic criminals. So just getting yourself in trouble once in your life and getting a couple-year sentence doesn't usually, in our experience, make your brain look extremely different than somebody who is, you know, from the same environmental background, same educational experiences, same IQ, et cetera. You tend to look very similar. So those are the two groups, that, or three, four groups, really, that we tend to examine and compare. But we're mostly interested in comparing the high psychopathy group to the low psychopathy group.
Okay.
And when you were talking about, you know, maybe being able to have some level of interventions when you have isolated the areas that are implicated, what kind of treatment are you foreseeing?
Well, right now we're actually actively putting in grants to implement a treatment program. I believe it was also cited in the article by somebody who I consider to be really a pioneer in the field. His name is Michael Caldwell. And he has actually designed and implemented a treatment program for youth who score high on the youth version.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't typically refer to them as having psychopathy because it's not a diagnosis that's given until over the age of 18. But so for these youth who are really high on these traits, he tried to design a program that was specifically to intervene with them, and it's mostly cognitive behavioral. He refers to it as what's called decompression treatment. And it's now considered the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center's standard protocol. It's very intensive. I believe there's one psychologist per 5 or 10 inmates, one psychiatrist per 20. There's one teacher per 3. And so it's a very intensive one-on-one or very small groups, 1, 2, or 3 youth who are getting very, you know, 6 months to a year, almost every day, intensive therapy. And the what he's shown, which is the reason why we're talking about it, is that in a 5-year follow-up, he's shown a 50% reduction in violent crime in the kids who went through this program compared to the kids that were just in the system as normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of return on your investment is staggering. I mean, it's over a 7 times cost savings because the reduced crime and the reduced incarceration from after treating these kids and then having them being successfully reintegrated makes an enormous cost savings and argues very heavily for implementing this, you know, really upfront for all juvenile offenders.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of challenges some of the beliefs about some of the problems with conduct disorder that's often seen related to attachment, and that if you don't get them under the age of 10, that, you know, the outcomes are much poorer.
Well, so conduct disorder, again, to be a little pedantic, we want to be really careful what we mean by saying youth psychopathy. So conduct disorder is kind of a general catchment term that's used to describe children who basically get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actually over 32,000 different combinations of items a child could have that could lead to a diagnosis of conduct disorder, which would suggest that there are 32,000 different types of conduct disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And we would obviously say that's not the case. And what you do is when you look at the severity of conduct disorder, and in particular if you assess the interpersonal and affective traits like the lack of empathy and the difficulty with any, you know, verbalizing or experiencing any guilt and the glibness, and when you assess those traits carefully in youth, which you don't typically do well with the DSM conduct disorder diagnosis, you end up with only about 20% of the conduct disorder kids who receive that diagnosis actually score high. And it's those 20% that we think actually are likely to lead to a very long-term persistent personality disorder or problem as adults. And so we really want to be careful when we talk about conduct disorder because it's not a very useful diagnosis because of such heterogeneity. And so we really believe strongly that you want to assess those other traits, which are done now with the youth version of the psychopathy checklist,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's really, in fact, the risk assessment and the stuff that's come out show that those traits, the lack of empathy, guilt, and remorse, those traits, especially when they're in conjunction with impulsivity, acting out, and other things, are still, like in the adult, the very best predictor of violent recidivism in youth. And so we would like to be able to modify or manage, help the youth and manage those traits much more effectively that hopefully can reduce them and can reduce the incidence. So that, to get back to your question, that's a treatment program that I'm advocating, which is as a front line. I mean, if you could reduce violence by 50%
mm-hmm.
and youths with this trait with just talking to them, right? Mm-hmm. No drugs, just talking to them, that's a tremendous benefit. And then I think what you do is you take the kids who still recidivate, even after they've gone through successfully this program, and then those are the kids that might need additional, maybe psychiatric or pharmaceutical intervention to help them further manage their impulsivity, for example, or some other aspect of that we can manage with pharmaceuticals right now. So
Have you been in there to watch the therapy and process?
I've only read the treatment manuals and guidelines and all the papers that have been published. I actually have not visited the facility to see the program, but it's supposed to be a very therapeutic environment. That means it kind of looks and feels, and it's different than a classic institutional environment. And it is supposed to be, it's supposed to be that kind of environment for working with kids, yeah.
So with the MRI, first of all, is that done with the MRI is done with contrast?
Oh, absolutely not. Contrast is an invasive.
Right.
MRI, yeah, so if you're going to ever do research with prisoners is, governed by the Office of Human Research Protections, or OHRP, and they only allow research to be done with prisoners if it falls under a couple of different guidelines. But any research that falls under these different guidelines has to be considered non-invasive. And MRIs are considered non-invasive unless you're using contrast or unless you're doing sedating, like for children, young children. So absolutely not. So we would not be allowed to do any contrast or any type of an injection.
Right.
Actually,
right.
Wouldn't be allowed.
So do you foresee the expansion of using the MRI in the future, perhaps on looking at brain differences in any of the other personality disorders?
Well, so we're currently working, we're hoping, keeping our fingers crossed, that a proposal that we have to work with women who are incarcerated, and there we would be studying things like borderline personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, as well as psychopathy in women.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, in terms of if you think that it'll be expanded into other types of personality problems within forensic populations, well, we're pretty much scanning every inmate that volunteers. So
mm-hmm.
if one was interested, for example, in narcissistic personality disorder
mm-hmm.
with or without, comorbidity with psychopathy, because they're comorbid,
right.
Then one could look at that as well. So we do a very comprehensive psychiatric disorder in our example. So certain one could look at that. Will it be expanded? I would certainly hope so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our program's going really well. I think it's a great resource. We're making it available to other researchers who are interested in collaborating and doing some of their own work with this population. So I certainly think it's all possible.
Mm-hmm. And are you seeing similarities maybe in the limbic regions with some of these other disorders or in other segments of the brain, like BP with borderline and histrionic, similarly affected areas of the brain?
I think you asked the question, are the paralimbic abnormalities generalizing to other personality disorders?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. We haven't answered that question yet or even tried to. We're really, right now at the time, just presently, analyzing all the data with respect to psychopathy. So I haven't had a chance to look in great detail whether or not any of the other personality disorders are making a large or a significant input. So it's a very good question, but it's something that we'll have to try to look at in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question about some of the things that you read on the internet. So for a while, there's been popular articles in the press about this kind of work on the brain scans of psychopathic individuals. And so people get talking and think that this will be able to be used as a test, as the PCLR is, as if we can somehow test a person and just by scanning their brain see if they're a psychopath or not. Do you think this is realistic at all?
You're really breaking up. I'm not sure.
Okay.
What kind of connection? Are you on a speakerphone, or is there any way you can?
I'm on my computer right now. I'm going to try to just. Sandra, do you think I can leave the call, and can you call me back onto it?
Go ahead.
It just got better for you.
Okay. Yeah, because I've been getting some weird signal too.
I'm happy if you want to hang up and call me again, see if you get a better connection, or I can hear you right now. So do you want to just ask that question again?
Okay, sure. My question is if the possibility of using brain scans to predict psychopathy in a person is, if that is a feasible thing, or if it isn't really possible at this time or in the future?
That's a very good question. I think that it would, so for example, even if we look within, you know, let's say we have 100 individuals with psychopathy that we're going to examine, would they be extremely homogeneous, and would the brain imaging data be diagnostic, you know, of brain differences? So one question that we can ask is actually, if we ask an algorithm, a computer algorithm, to say, take everybody that has, you know, a 5% reduction in cortical thickness, let's say in the paralimbic system, and you put them in one group, and then you take everybody else that doesn't, and you put them in another group, would that mapping then correspond to close to PCLR mapping?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's possible, like many disorders, that the only way to diagnose it is like at autopsy, like, for example, Alzheimer's disease. You know, unless you get in there and actually do an autopsy, you can't necessarily diagnose something.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, for all forensic purposes, you know, the PCLR is the diagnostic test for psychopathy, and it's been so widely used and so well validated and so well replicated across, you know, like 40 different countries. It's really hard to see that, you know, in my lifetime, that MRI might someday eclipse it as a diagnostic test. The other thing to note, I mean, doing a psychopathy interview and assessment, you know, takes probably about 4 to 5 hours for a trained individual to do, and it costs, you know, probably somewhere between $200 to $500, you know, to have it done if you do it clinically.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an MRI scan, to do one clinically like that, would probably be close to $2,000 or $3,000. Plus, problem really comes down to, there's only so many MRIs, but there's a lot more people that are trained to do the PCLR.
Yeah.
So it would be a logistical thing that could be very difficult to do. I could see in certain high-profile cases where an attorney wants to know, my client is or isn't a psychopath, can we bring him to a facility, have him scanned, and then compare to our database, for example, to determine whether or not the algorithm says he does or doesn't have similar brain differences. So that might be used a little bit differently in the legal system. You might say, like, because we might find some psychopaths that even though they score high on psychopathy, they don't have any brain differences, whereas those that do have brain differences might be maybe harder to treat or something like that.
Yeah.
And then that, I could see that the legal system might compel, you know, MRIs if we have a significant enough findings. And that's something that we're actually studying and examining these questions within the MacArthur Foundation's Law and Neuroscience Project. I'm sure you're familiar with the MacArthur Foundation. They fund large-scale research networks to try to help understand and delineate, like, anything from risk assessment in forensic facilities, mental health issues, juvenile justice issues. And more recently, they just funded a network, fortunate to be a member on this network, that is designed to try to tackle big questions regarding whether or not neuroscience, and brain imaging in particular, how that might change the legal system. And psychopathy is one of the test cases. So if you have a psychopathy and you have a big brain difference, how does that impact or influence or change any of your legal standing or the legal system? Is it relevant to insanity defense? Is it relevant to sentencing? Is it relevant to culpability? Is it relevant to prediction of, you know, recidivism? And so those are all big questions that we're trying to look at right now. So those are very good questions, very timely.
Okay. And that leads to another question I've got about subclinical or subcriminal psychopathy. So your work has been mainly, I think that's Sandra, I think that's your computer that's making that noise.
It is?
Well, it's showing, well, we're on Skype, Dr. Keel, and I'm reading your signal, and it's spiking with those noises. So
maybe is it still doing it?
Yeah. Can you hear that, Dr. Keel?
It comes in and out a little bit, but I can hear you now, yeah.
Okay.
So you were asking about subclinical psychopathy in reference to...
Well, because your work has been mainly on criminal populations, have you had a... Well, is there... it just seems that there's a lot of questions that would come up about that. If we can't study subcriminal psychopaths, how can we really know what the differences are between the two groups? Would there be brain differences?
Sure. So you're actually asking to determine whether or not there is a... So I would call subclinical psychopathy also by non-psychopathic offenders, but you're talking about like psychopaths who have never been incarcerated, for
yes.
example?
Yeah.
So that's a very good question. To my knowledge, such a person is extremely rare, even within the psychopathy group. So, for example, it might only be like 1 out of 50 psychopaths may not have actually spent any time in jail or prison.
Okay.
And the reason being, we've done some different math to try to figure this out, how many psychopaths actually spend time in jail based on epidemiological data. And it would suggest that, I'm not going to go through all the math with you, but basically anywhere between 80 to 100% of psychopaths at some point in their life are likely to spend some time in prison, in jail particularly.
Okay.
So that's because they're reckless, blah, blah, blah. But nevertheless, even if actually it's quite interesting, if you go look at what some people have called successful psychopaths,
mm-hmm.
those that are not getting incarcerated, and you ask them to self-report how much criminal behavior they've actually conducted, you find out that they actually report more criminal behavior than the ones that have said they've done time.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, in those types of... So that means that the behavior is the same, there just might be some sort of protective factor that's keeping them from going to prison. And one might be they're totally lying about it because these studies typically don't verify through, you know, that they haven't ever spent time in jail or prison. And there's a lot of people that you interview, you know, even, you know, in this context, they'll tell you, I haven't done any time in jail. But then when you look at their record, you see that, yeah, they did time all over the country. But it's only when you really look that you can confirm it. And then they're like, oh, yeah, I didn't think you wanted to know about that, you know.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, that being said, the behaviors are the same typically. So that means to me there might be something like maybe IQ is slightly higher in the successful one than the non-successful one. They might be from slightly higher socioeconomic status, so they've had better access to legal attorneys and stuff like that. The other thing that the real question, I think, what most people want to know is, are people like, you know, Madoff, you know, a psychopath? Is Michael Milken a psychopath? Is, you know, Ken Lay a psychopath? Is George Bush a psychopath? I mean, people ask these types of questions all the time, and the answer that I typically give is that these people probably have some psychopathic traits. I mean, they're a little more impulsive, they're maybe a little superficial, they might have a little bit of lack of empathy, but psychopathy is classically defined as a personality disorder that causes impairment in most aspects of your life, like impairments in relationships, impairments with family relationships as well as romantic relationships, impairments in occupational, maintaining and keeping the same job, impairments in education, and if to be a disorder, it really has to cause impairments in all of those areas. Now, so if you want to call somebody, you know, the halftime psychopath who basically only has, you know, some of these traits, well, I wouldn't call them a psychopath. But I would say that it might not be good to have that person in a business role, in like a very big business role, if they're going to make very self-serving and other types of, you know, decisions that are really going to be not in the best interest of the company or in the best interest of society. So I think that can certainly be the case. But I don't know if we would see that those same people would be showing differences. I mean, even there's been very little work done in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, you know, that might work with, I don't know, half a dozen senators right now and a handful of governors. That have been sentenced to federal prison, it would be very interesting to do the assessments in them, or even for that matter, to try to do a psychopathy assessment like in, you know, go to every Ivy League and study everybody before they enter business school and look and see if you can do a comprehensive assessment of psychopathy and then see if that predicts, you know, it's probably a U-shaped function, to be honest with you, where low psychopathy, who are conscientious and good, et cetera, and high psychopathy, would be, you know, the high, actually maybe not quite a U-shaped function, but It might be that some people with some psychopathic traits are actually very successful at business, but too much psychopathic traits and you're not going to be successful. You might fail miserably. And where I was getting at was that then low scores might be just average income earners because they're very conscientious and they don't do the cutthroat things that some people need to do to be business. So I think that would be a very interesting study to look at. We considered doing it, but people, when I was at Yale, but it just became, it would be very labor intensive and very difficult to try to interview all of those people and do that assessment, to do it right. I mean, you could give them a self-report psychopathy measure, but I don't think it would be sensitive enough to probe and get a true estimate of the disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you would have to interview them all, do background checks, et cetera. And then if you did that, then that would be very exciting to see, you know, 5-10 years, if it predict, you know, how does psychopathic traits predict or not predict economic stability, economic success, et cetera. So,
well, you mentioned some of these people might not be ideal for roles in business, unless they even politics. Would you think there would be any preventative measures for to kind of stop psychopaths from achieving, let's say, prominence in these roles? Because it still seems like it is a big danger to have a psychopath in a position where you require a bit of forethought and conscience and all these qualities. So how would we prevent people from like this from achieving these kind of positions?
So I think that probably the very best thing to do is just to keep educating everybody by doing talks like this and interviews like this, so that everybody understands that psychopathy is a condition. It is something that can be quantified, and it is something that you typically would want to avoid in business. But that's the big question. You know, we don't know if, you know, some score on some test of psychopathy actually predicts business or non-business success.
Mm-hmm.
But you could see that you wouldn't want somebody with all of those traits certainly being in your company. And maybe some companies might start to, you know, I know like certain aspects of the military, they screen out psychopaths from getting into certain elite forces and stuff like that, because whereas they're very good at doing things that they're told that are bad, they're not very good at minding manners when they're, you know, not in, otherwise engaged in an exciting thing. And so this has been talked about by a number of different writers or people who work with the military. So it might be that other people who are doing similar types of things, like contractors, for example, do military contracting, well, they would really not want to have somebody that has all of these traits there, because they could really put them at a grave liability. It might be the same thing for other, you know, professions you might want to screen out somebody, prison guards, for example, or some other thing that they might gravitate towards. You wouldn't want those types of traits there. So if there might be some sort of human resources way of trying to help screen people out that's pretty sensitive to it. I know some people are trying to develop things like this. So those would all be useful things. In terms of preventative, I mean, that's the best thing that I can think of about being trying to preventative. But more and more, I think what we're finding is, just like, you know, 15 years ago, no one really knew what autism was. They just had kids who just acted differently, and they were not necessarily diagnosed accurately or correctly or anything. And hopefully what we'll see in the future is much more accurate diagnosis of kids who are beginning to, you know, illustrate some of these traits. And then there'll be people that go, hey, there's this treatment that you can work with to help remediate those problems that your child's having. And, you know, like it hurt the animal, but it didn't even care about it. Maybe there are certain ways that we can try to fix traits like that. So that's what I would hope would happen, is that there'd be more education, more understanding, and hopefully much more opportunities for treatment.
Well, and one of the problems with the education factor is, take the DSM-4, for example, which still doesn't recognize psychopathy as a main personality disorder. I guess I'd ask, what are your thoughts on that, on the DSM controversy, and is there any hope of the DSM-5 recognizing psychopathy?
This is a good question. You know, even the APA president, Alan Kazdin, who is American Psychological Association president, he's, you know, considered one of the world's best people who work with chronic disorder. He's the one that published that there are over 32,000 different combinations of items that to diagnose conduct disorder. And yet, I don't know that they're even consulting with him, it's like a psychiatric group that's doing the field trials, about revising the conduct disorder diagnosis. So you can, I think the proper way to view the DSM is to simply recognize that it is a very blunt tool. It's designed to give clinicians essentially a quick, you know, a way of saying, I believe that this individual has this diagnosis. But hopefully most people go far beyond just the DSM. For example, if you have somebody who's diagnosed with schizophrenia and meets criterion and you're about to prescribe medicine, you're going to assess exactly what their symptoms are. Did they have primarily positive symptoms that are best treated with this drug, or did they have primarily negative symptoms that are best treated with this drug? And the DSM doesn't tell you what drugs to use or what treatment to use or even what symptoms are treated by what drugs. And so it takes a good psychiatrist to go know that literature, know that there are different drugs that are optioned, know that additional assessments have to be made once a diagnosis is made in the DSM. And if the same thing was true for psychopathy, so you're in a prison system, you've done a DSM, you get an ASPD, antisocial personality disorder diagnosis, and then you go, wow, I might be dealing with somebody with psychopathy, let's use the measure that was designed for the prison. Because the DSM was never designed for prison use. It has no forensic norms. It's basically just a blunt tool that's designed to give clinicians a framework. And I guess the flip side, so the DSM, you know, ASPD really only assesses the behavioral things, getting in trouble, acting out, impulsivity, that all clinicians can agree somebody's doing. The reason why they didn't include lack of empathy, guilt, remorse, superficial charm, you know, poor responsibility, and all those interpersonal and affective traits was because most clinicians, when you first meet them, a client, they don't have the skill to know, and there's not the context or the framework within the DSM for them to accurately describe how to assess it, lack of empathy. So, like, for example, it's a